Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day.
This testimony, your directive, your performance is shameful.
Hey, that's not correct.
Thank God you are not on the Supreme Court. You should resign in disgrace, Judge.
That is Senator Tom Cotton blasting the Attorney General of the United States for directing the FBI and the Department of Justice to go after parents who show up to loudly object to the indoctrination of their children in American schools. And this is the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to the best conversation in talk journalism, and you're welcome to join the conversation anytime you like. Just dial me up at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for more than 21 years, delivering honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest. I got to tell you something. I think this is so important. I decided to lead off with it today because I think so many parents are so troubled by what their schools have and have not delivered to their kids. And now with the FDA approving vaccination for children as young as 5, the next question you're going to have to confront, and parents certainly have a right to object, is, are you going to force my kid to get vaccinated? I'll get to that a bit later. The National School Board Association has already apologized for characterizing concerned parents showing up at school board meetings as, get this, potential domestic terrorists. Now, that letter went to the White House. But somehow the Attorney General, who claims the White House never called him up, never told him to act, within 4 days, he had crafted a memo. And the memo directed the FBI and the DOJ to meet with local law enforcement and go after parents. Parents who just show up and, for the most part, loudly object to things that their school districts are doing. Things like mask mandates, things like vaccine mandates, things like indoctrination of their children to an evil, evil philosophy called critical race theory, which segregates your kids based on the color of their skin. I know, it's like being back in Alabama in the 1940s. They objected to hypersexualized indoctrination of their children on issues like transgender. And today, Texas Senator Ted Cruz is among the senators challenging Attorney General Garland for targeting American parents who are merely exercising their rights to free speech and their right to petition their government for redress of grievances. In this case, government in the form of a school board. Take a listen to Cruz.
How many of them were violent? Do you know?
I don't know.
You don't know. And there's a reason you don't know. Because you didn't care, and nobody in your office cared to find out. I did a quick count just sitting here. During this hearing, I counted 20 incidents cited. Of the 20, 15 on their face are nonviolent. They involve things like insults. They involve a Nazi salute. That's one of the examples. My God, a parent did a Nazi salute at a school board because he thought the policies were oppressive. General Garland is doing a Nazi salute at an elected official. Is that protected by the First Amendment?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. And then Senator Josh Hawley pointed out that the memo from the Attorney General now has DOJ assistant attorneys around America writing their own memos threatening criminal prosecution of parents for free speech. Listen to that.
You issued a memo, you, over your signature, issued a memo involving the FBI and the Department of Justice in local school boards, local school districts. Your U.S. attorneys are now threatening prosecution with 13 different crimes, but it's not a high enough priority for you. It got lost in the mix.
I'll send again. I've never seen that memo.
It was. That's what concerns me, General Garland.
Well, it wasn't sent to me.
Yeah, now I got to tell you, the whole dispute really goes back to one signature incident. Now, there are other incidents that got involved as well, but the one signature incident came in the Commonwealth of Virginia in a county called Loudoun County. And what happened? A man showed up at the school board to object to the school board. And why? Because his daughter was raped and sodomized in a school bathroom. And the suspect in the case is a transgender student, a boy dressed as a girl who's accused of following the girl into the restroom and then doing absolutely horrendous criminal acts to her. And the local school board was concerned this is going to come out during Pride Month. It's going to upset all the woke folks. The father of the girl went to his school board to complain about the transgender policies that let that suspect student, who was already suspected in another sexual crime against another student, stay in school. So the father got loud, and then the police arrested him. Listen to Tom Cotton.
You keep citing news reports, and that's the most prominent news report that anyone in America has seen. That refers to Scott Smith, whose 15-year-old daughter was raped. She was raped in a bathroom by a boy wearing girls' clothes, and the Loudoun County School Board covered it up because it would have interfered with their transgendered policy during Pride Month. And that man, Scott Smith, because he went to a school board and tried to defend his daughter's rights, was condemned internationally. Do you apologize to Scott Smith and his 15-year-old daughter, Judge?
Senator, anyone whose child was raped is the most horrific crime I can imagine and is certainly entitled and protected by the First Amendment to protest to their school board about this.
But he was cited by the School Board Association as a domestic terrorist, which we now know that letter and those reports were the basis for your...
No, Senator, that's wrong.
Judge, this is shameful. This testimony, your directive, your performance is shameful.
Okay. That's not...
Thank God you are not on the Supreme Court. You should resign in disgrace, Judge.
Yeah, I agree with him. Senator Cruz points out that school boards around the country are now quitting the National School Boards Association for the letter to the White House that set all this off. And the association has now retracted its letter. But Attorney General Garland refuses. He says, I will not dissolve the task force that he formed supposedly to investigate threats leveled by parents against school board members, except that most of it was free speech. Again, let's go back to Ted Cruz questioning Merrick Garland.
Do you understand why the parent would be upset?
Absolutely, and is any expressions of upset are completely protected by the First Amendment.
Except you just called him a domestic terrorist.
I never called him that. That's not correct.
This letter calls him a domestic terrorist. You based a direction to the FBI, an official direction from the Attorney General, on this letter, and I'll tell you what, the NSBA is so embarrassed of this letter, they've apologized for it and retracted it, but you don't apparently have the same willingness to apologize and retract what you did.
No, he does not. Since the Attorney General reacted so quickly, some senators have questioned whether Garland did it, not just because of the Biden White House, but because the Attorney General's son-in-law has literally made millions of dollars through his company that sells critical race theory propaganda materials to the public schools. Listen to Cruz demanding an answer from Garland on the ethics of that.
Did you seek and receive a decision from an ethics advisor at the Department of Justice before you carried out an action that would have a predictable financial benefit to your son-in-law?
This memorandum is aimed at violence and threats.
I just asked a question. Did you seek an ethics
opinion?
It
has no
predictable... Did you seek an ethics opinion? Judge, you know how to ask questions and answer them. Did you seek an ethics opinion?
You asked me whether I sought an ethics opinion about something that would have a predictable effect on something. This has no predictable effect in the way that you're talking about.
Coming up, we'll talk about a new tax proposed for America's billionaires on the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Well, you may have heard already that Ron Wyden wants a wealth tax. The senator claims he only wants to tax the super, super rich. But I'm going to warn you about the history of taxes in America. Wyden calls his new idea the billionaire's income tax. And I know the first reaction you might have is, I don't know any billionaires. As far as I know, there are no billionaires listening to the show today, although Elon Musk or Bill Gates is welcome to call in anytime he likes. He might even call in as a naysayer. Only the tax from Wyden, the billionaire's tax, does not tax income. It taxes what the good old Internal Revenue Service calls unrealized gains. Now, that's a fancy term that CPAs and tax attorneys, they know what it means. Average folks have those unrealized gains as well. For example, the equity in your home. If your house went up in value since you first bought it, on paper, you've made money. You might say, well, I bought this house for $300,000. Now it's worth $400,000. You have an unrealized gain of $100,000. The stocks in your IRA or your 401k that have increased in value, those are also capital gains. You pay taxes on them when you sell them. And so do the wealthy, even the billionaires. Wyden wants the taxes now on money you haven't made yet. Let me remind you, 108 years ago, the Congress invented the income tax we still have today. Now, technically speaking, the first income tax was in the 1860s, but it only lasted for 11 years. It was intended to pay off the Civil War. In fact, it kind of broke that rule of government that once you invent a new tax, you never get rid of it. They actually got rid of that one. But in 1913, when the first income tax, the thing we still have around our necks today, when that was created by the U.S. Congress, the average American made about $300 a year. Let me let that sink in. $300 a year. Congress said, we promise the tax will only be paid by people who make 10 times as much money. The minimum rate would be 1% above $3,000. Well, that promise didn't last for very long. Today, the average worker pays not 1% or 5% or 10%. The average worker in America pays 14% of his entire paycheck on a tax originally proposed, remember this, for the ultra-rich, kind of like Senator Wyden's tax. It's only on billionaires. Don't worry, you're not a billionaire. So when a man like Ron Wyden, who has never had a real job outside of politics and yet somehow managed to become a multimillionaire and then to marry another multimillionaire, when that man who lives in New York City but pretends to represent Oregon, 2,500 miles away, when he promises to only tax the super, super wealthy, I want you to remember that history. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, for the Daily Grill, I'm going to give it to Nicholas Kristof, who is, like Wyden, another carpetbagger from New York. Now, you say, but he was born here in Oregon. He grew up here in Oregon. That's fine. He grew up here in Oregon. So what? He now wants to run for governor. Well, what's the requirement to run for governor? It's very easy to read the requirement. The requirement simply says you have to have been a resident for 3 years. Does he meet that requirement? He does not. He voted in New York City. And by the way, to vote in New York State, you have to swear that you are a resident of New York State. He voted in New York State last November, less than a year ago. And yet he's running in the primary to get the Democrat Party nomination to run for governor in May of next year. Now, that's not 3 years. I mean, I can do the math on that one, and yet he proposes to run as another carpetbagger, just like Ron Wyden. And from Getter, I got this comment from somebody who signs himself or herself Tortitude. If the DNC wants him to run, they'll figure out some loophole, or Democrats in the Oregon House and Senate will pass a bill that Brown Shirt will sign to let him run. We already have one Democrat carpetbagger in Wyden who's destroying the state and the U.S. We cannot afford another one. Now, if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, and I do want to talk about this new approval from the FDA to vaccinate children, because I predict that you parents are going to have to go to your school boards and tell them no in a very loud voice. And at that point, you're then running afoul of the aforementioned Merrick Garland and the FBI. You may have the FBI down your throat if you decide to loudly object, but I think you should loudly object. But let me get to that in a moment. If you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And today's best email of the day is brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest. Now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus online at rivercityusa.com/careers. Diane writes in, Lars, your story about Dr. Fauci's funding of research torturing dogs with sand fleas was terrifying. I think Fauci needs to be sedated, have his head put in a cage, and let sand fleas have their way with him. That would be humane. He does not deserve better for this inhumane treatment of animals. Now, I mentioned a moment ago, yesterday afternoon, late in the day, the advisory panel that tells the FDA what it thinks should happen, 17 medical doctors, they voted 17 to nothing with one abstention. All of these doctors said, let's go ahead and approve Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children. Now, if you want your kids to be vaccinated, that's your choice as a parent. It should not be the choice of the school board. But here's something I want to play for you. Dr. Eric Rubin is one of the doctors on that panel. And some of the doctors on the panel said, we're kind of queasy. They've only tested this vaccine on 3,000 kids. Listen carefully to what Dr. Eric Rubin, a member of the panel that advises the FDA and gave its approval for vaccinating kids from 5 to 11, listen to what he says. It's very short.
But we're never going to learn about how safe the vaccine is unless we start giving it. That's just the way it goes.
We're never going to learn about how safe this vaccine is unless we just start giving it. That's just the way it goes. We know that on older kids, the vaccines have caused inflammation of the heart called myocarditis. And they have said that they're going to give a lesser dose for the little kids out there. They're giving about one-third the usual dose, and they say they hope it will be effective, the lower dose, in preventing COVID, and they hope it won't have a bad effect. But as Dr. Rubin said, we're never going to learn whether or not it's safe until we start giving it to the kids. It's kind of like Nancy Pelosi's attitude on legislation. We got to pass the bill to find out what's inside the bill. It's one thing to do that with a piece of legislation on Capitol Hill or in your state legislature. It's quite another to say, hey, doc, is this vaccine safe for my kid? Well, we're certainly going to find out after we stick the needle in him, aren't we? Is that the kind of medicine you want practiced and mandated by your local school board? Glad to have you with me on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS and send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network, should taxpayers pay the garbage bill for the bums on the streets? We'll get to that up next. Welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. If you've driven around any of the bigger cities of the Pacific Northwest, as Tina and I have, it just makes your eyes hurt to see the damage that is done by the bums, the concrete campers, the so-called homeless, or now they call them houseless people, who have just trashed up the entire environment. It's dangerous. It's unsanitary. It occasionally catches fire. I mean, we've had fires in both Oregon and Washington associated with these homeless camps. And at the very least, we'd like to see the garbage cleaned up. Well, Aaron Mesh, who's the news editor at Willamette Week, his paper has a story this week, rather interesting one, about a kind of an entrepreneurial garbage guy who said to the city, in this case, Portland, hey, I could put a dumpster down there and all the bums could put their trash in it. It was kind of a come on, it sounds like, for him to get paid at some point, which didn't sound entirely kosher to me. But then something else happened. Aaron, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars, how you doing?
Not too bad. Would you sketch out this story about the enterprising guy who said, hey, why don't I put a dumpster down there and all the bums can throw their trash in it and I'll haul it away?
So Jamie Wacker owns Wacker Sanitary. It's a Portland company that's a garbage contractor. And like many trash hauling contractors, it contracts among its clients that it contracts with is the city of Portland. So it was late last month. He was driving by a pedestrian bridge in North Portland and noticed that there were a number of people camping there and that trash was piling up. When he spoke to the people who lived at that campsite, they said, well, one of the reasons the trash is piling up here is because we have one small city garbage can and it's overrun with vermin and there's no place for us to put any trash. And there's no trash service here. So he said, I think I can solve that problem. And weeks later, he installed a 6-foot-long metal dumpster, and the area around that campsite is clean. Now, as you've pointed out, the city of Portland is may or may not be receiving an invoice from him for $200, what's called a tipping fee, which is to bring the garbage truck by and toss the contents of that dumpster into the garbage truck once a week. He hasn't decided whether or not he's going to invoice the city for this. And I think to some degree, he's planning to invoice the city less as like a get-rich scheme and far more as a kind of making your point kind of invoice to say, like, look,
that's
there's
fair.
Something you could have already hired me to do. I don't think he expects to get paid for this. He said he may not even bother to put it on the invoice. He wanted to do it because he thought it was a good idea. And I think he'd like to make a little note to the city that they could have done this themselves.
Yeah, and that's not a bad deal. But then what really fascinated me, and you got to see this story at WWeek.com. I highly recommend it. And, you know, because Aaron's nice enough to come on and talk about these stories, and I recommend that you read them. I mean, whether I agree with what's in them or not. But what got really crazy was the city said, no, we're not going to do this. But the reason we're not going to do it is because regular citizens, in other words, tax-paying, law-abiding people who actually either rent or own the place where they live, and they're not camped out like the concrete campers are, they're putting their trash in it too. And we don't want to pay the bill for regular citizens, you know, law-abiding citizens. We only want to pay the bill for people who've decided to camp on public property and make themselves a nuisance. I know that's probably not the way you'd sum it up, Aaron, but that's the way I'd sum it up.
Sure, I wouldn't frame it that way, but I do think you've arrived at an interesting conflict, which is that the city says that the idea of putting dumpsters next to homeless encampments is a mistake because people will see those places as destinations, almost like way stations where they can bring their own stuff. They say that the biggest problem is that people keep bringing large items like furniture, like abandoning their couches at these locations if they see a dumpster there. You know, while you and I wouldn't phrase these things the same way, I think that there is an irony there that we would agree on, which is that perhaps the city could see this as a little bit of the cost of doing business for neighborhoods that they have neglected over the past 5 years.
Well, I'd also point this out. I mean, ordinarily, Aaron, you get things by going by the rules. So what they're saying is if the law-abiding want to use the dumpster, they can't. We only want to supply services to people whose lifestyle is frankly obnoxious, in some cases dangerous, I think in some cases criminal, you know, and so yeah, you're telling citizens, you guys pay your taxes and we'll take care of their garbage. In the meantime, you citizens, you have to pay your own garbage bill. Now, I think it's more than irony. It's a poke in the face. You're going to pay the bills for the people who don't follow the rules, and we're going to take your money and use it to benefit the people who don't follow the rules.
Yeah, I wouldn't see it that way. Again, chiefly because I don't think that you can categorize people as more or less obnoxious based on their poverty standard. What I do
It's not about poverty. It's about their behavior. There are plenty of poor people out there, Aaron, who pay their bills. And they call this show and they're proud of it. They say, look, I don't make a lot of money, but I pay my bills. And they're proud of that. What the city is saying is, if you just decide to say, hell with it, I'm going to live where I want to live. I'm not going to pay rent. I'm going to throw my trash out the front door of my tent. I'm going to use the side of the street or the side of the freeway as a toilet. I'm going to leave my dirty needles for my other illegal behavior. I'm going to leave those everywhere for your kids to step on. Oh, and by the way, it's your job to pick up my trash. I mean, that's an obnoxious attitude. And I think the reason a lot of these people are on the streets, Aaron, perfectly, I say, why aren't they staying with family and friends? I bet every single one of them had run out their welcome at family and friends' homes because of their obnoxious behavior.
Well, I tend to sympathize with people who no one likes. So, I mean, I get it. No one really likes
me. So you
me.
Like Donald
so
Trump?
What's that?
I just threw Trump in there. I thought I had to.
Oh, I don't think that's accurate because a lot of people like Donald Trump.
Yes,
I think
do.
Donald Trump is way more I think if you're asking, like, who's the more popular figure, a Portland homeless person or Donald Trump, I bet Trump's going to get more votes. I don't know.
I'd even bet Trump up against Biden. Trump is more popular than Biden right now.
I don't think there's a real argument that Joe Biden is lacking in popularity at the moment, though that may not be entirely on topic here.
No, but let's get back to this. So is the city going to say...
Opining aside, which I recognize is the job of your show, let's just like hop back to what's happening here, which is that the city continues to say that dumpsters aren't the answer here. The city thinks that the answer is going to be a plan to distribute trash bags and then have local businesses and nonprofits pick up those trash bags in a kind of weekly shadow garbage service that works like a trash hauling service, but only dedicated to homeless camps. I find myself skeptical that that's going to be the methodology that's going to work here. But it's something we're going to be tracking.
Well, and isn't it a little obnoxious, too? Businesses and individuals who pay their taxes, who pay the rent, who clean up their own property, sometimes even clean up the street and the sidewalk in front of their property, which is not necessarily their job, are now going to be asked, can you also pick up for these people who are thoroughly irresponsible and the city won't hold them to any level of responsibility, pick up for them too? If I were a business owner, I'd tell you to pound sand if you were the mayor asking me to do that.
It was interesting because we spoke to a person who lives in the neighborhood who actually felt a little differently, felt that that the city pays too much attention to business owners and not enough attention to neighborhood residents, meaning people who live in houses. That they felt that if any time there was a homeless camp near a business, the city paid a lot of attention, and any time there was a homeless camp near someone's home, the city kind of just said, well, good luck.
Well, let me ask you how that works out. When you were a kid, Aaron, when you got to be a teenager and you were perfectly capable of doing it yourself, if you just, when you came home, took off your dirty clothes and just threw them around the house, was your mom nice enough to pick up after you indefinitely and make sure that she cleaned up after you? Were you raised that way?
No.
I didn't think you were. In fact, I was reasonably certain you were. What would your mom have said if you'd said, Mom, I dropped all my dirty clothes. Go get them and put them in the wash. What would Mom have said? Is it? Can you repeat it on the radio?
I was going to say, I can't repeat that. We have SEC laws.
That's Aaron Mesh. Find the story at WWeek.com. Coming up, a Seattle hotel, and how do they get the bums out there? We'll get to that in your calls next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if you want to join the conversation, especially if you're a naysayer, you'll go right to the head of the line. I love this story that I saw. I don't like the content of the story, but the fact that the Seattle Times fish wrapper was willing to do this story. They talk about a guy from Spokane who lends private money, he's inland capital, and lent some money to an 11-unit motel. Unfortunately, it was one of the bad neighborhoods of Seattle. And then what happened was the owner who had borrowed the money just defaulted on the loan. And there was a deadly arson at the apartment building. And you find out that all of a sudden you can't get rid of people in the building. Even if, in this case, Seattle police just a couple of weeks ago raided the place, found 2,200 fentanyl pills. Those are deadly for a lot of people. 405 grams of meth, some crack cocaine, 7 dogs, 4 puppies. Nobody arrested, a suspect identified, and they said, yeah, we got a bigger investigation. But not being able to get rid of people, this is a problem where cities have decided that if you're a law-abiding citizen, they will go after you tooth and nail. If you won't take the vaccine, they will fire you and drive you out of your profession. On the other hand, if you decided to behave in a completely antisocial way, antisocial, anti-American, anti-everything, they will stand by you and say, no, you can't touch that person. You have to leave them alone. Now, to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's start with Meg. Hey, Meg, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
You bet, Lars. I love your show. And not trying to solve the whole homeless problem because it's such an issue and so complex, and I definitely get your point. It's mostly addicts that are just not able to get through their addiction to become, civilians of our cities, and the way they're trashing them is just abhorrent. But I was thinking about the guy that was offering up the dumpsters and that, and how residents are wanting to throw their large trash. Well, why couldn't they gate these dumpsters off and just keep them locked except for certain hours? Let the camps know that this is when you can bring your trash here and get rid of it and keep your spaces clean. At least that will help the situation. It's certainly not an answer to it in the long run, but it's something for now. That's all.
It's an interesting idea, Meg. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. You know what I want them to do? I want them to do what they do to every single other citizen. You have to follow the rules. If you own a home and you let it fall into disrepair, the city will come by and nick you. If you have a tree and the tree falls down, you have to deal with it in some fashion. If your sidewalk is in bad repair, cities will come by and say, you fix that or we will fix it and send you the bill. And yet, for some reason, they just go ahead and they give a certain class of people the license to do anything they want, anytime they want, and they don't have to pay any consequences whatsoever. On that note, let's go to Greg. Hey, Greg, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I just wanted to share my experience of going to the PPS meeting last night about mandating
public
vaccines.
Schools for everybody else listening. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah, I'm sorry. Portland Public Schools meeting at the Blanchard Education Service Center, and about the vaccine mandates for, you know, ages five and over.
Yep. They're coming. So it was, you know, they're coming.
It was, I unfortunately believe that, I got the feeling that they already have their mind made up. They already made their decision. I don't know, even know why they're wasting people's time with these meetings, you know, make them feel like they're going to have a voice.
I think they're going through the motions so they can say they went through the motions, Greg. I mean, people do that.
Absolutely.
And I don't think it's legitimate. I mean, I wish the boards would just say, look, we've already made up our mind, but if you want to sit there and open and close your mouth for 3 minutes, we'll let you do that if it makes you feel better, but we've already decided. I mean, why not be honest about it?
Right, right. So we, you know, when I got there last night, it was, you know, starting normal. Everybody was there. It was an overwhelming attendance of people that were against the vaccine mandates. You know, if there were 80 people in that room, I would say maybe 1% of people were for it. You know, there was probably less than 10 people that were for it.
Yep.
And so the meeting, you know, all the board members got out they started the meeting like 20 minutes late. And they said, okay, we're about to start the meeting, but everybody, you know, we're going to follow the CDC guidelines and everybody needs to be wearing a mask. And there were, I don't know, a handful of people, five or so people that weren't wearing masks, right? They weren't going to do it.
Yep.
So they said, and about, I think somebody timed it. They gave 29 seconds. They said, everybody needs to be wearing a mask. And then they said, okay, we're going to adjourn the meeting. She grabs her little gauntlet. And, and calls the meeting and just gets up. And
they got up and they went virtual, didn't they? They hid from the public.
They did. It was unbelievable. And, you know, you just got to, you know, I was just observing the room and you know, everybody else basically had a mask on. And you're going to worry about four or five people in a room that's masked. I'm sure most people are vaccinated and all this other stuff. And they're going to say, oh, for your protection and safety, you know, we need to make sure everybody has a mask on. And you should have seen the versions of masks in the room. Like, you know, people had like G-strings over their face. It was ridiculous. And it was like, give me a break. These things, and, you know, countless studies of masks don't work and blah, blah. It was just, it was ridiculous. It was very symbolic of the amount of effort that they want to put in to let people have a voice and hold these meetings and be just. Very symbolic of the lack of leadership and just it's so disappointing.
All they want, Greg, is compliance. If you fail to comply, then you're the wrong kind of citizen, and they close the meeting down. It's the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and we serve three different states through 25 great radio affiliates in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Your phone calls are welcome, and I'll get to those the next segment. There's something that I try to do every day, and that is I try to represent all of the concerns of this region. Now, when it comes to policing, I'm very glad that we have different police departments in different cities. God forbid we should ever have either just a state police force that is representing everybody in one state through law enforcement, or God forbid we didn't have a county sheriff, or in the case of King County, a county sheriff not chosen by the people, but chosen by elected bureaucrats, because I think there are flaws to that. And really, God forbid, we should ever have a federal police department the way that Joe Biden seems to want to do. But to be able to talk about all the police departments, there's no way to sum them all up. They're all somewhat different. But during this last year and a half, we've seen a lot of violence increase dramatically throughout the Pacific Northwest. Obviously, more in the bigger cities, less in the smaller cities. And I think there's some smaller cities that are very well policed, and they're represented well by their police. Tommy Walker joins me now, who's president of the Gresham Police Officers Association. Tommy, I said all that because in a lot of ways, I think the concerns you've raised about your city police department are reflected in most of the other communities around the Pacific Northwest to one extent or another. Welcome to the show, and would you agree with that proposition?
Well, first of all, Lars, thank you for having me on. I appreciate your time. And yes, I would absolutely agree with you. It's kind of funny because you mentioned King County a minute ago, and I kind of have the unique perspective. I've been in law enforcement now for 17 years. I actually started my career with the City of Seattle Police Department. I worked there for about 3 years, and now I represent the city of Gresham. And so I kind of had a front row seat for, you know, watching things dissolve, you know, in Seattle. And now I'm sitting here in Gresham, and I'm having some, you know, pretty...
Deja vu.
Yeah, you could call it that, deja vu for sure.
Well, I guess what I get, and the reason I badmouth the idea of a chosen sheriff instead of an elected sheriff, I've always said sheriffs are great because if you don't do the job and satisfy the voters, they're happy to throw you out and choose somebody else. And there are great examples like Joe Arpaio that kept people happy for decades. And there are other people who get changed all the time. And I've heard a lot of dissatisfaction from King County from deputies who say the fact that we have an appointed sheriff and a sheriff who doesn't really represent the people, but represents the desires of her boss because they chose her. And she in a lot of ways, she can say, I don't have anything to say to the people. The people didn't choose
absolutely.
Me. I don't.
Yeah, and
I think that, I
mean,
I think that's dangerous.
That's what we're lucky. Go ahead.
I think that's dangerous.
No, I agree with you 100%. And I mean, that's the thing about, you know, having an elected official, you know, in terms of the sheriff is because they have certain First Amendment protections and things that they can say because they were elected by a group of people. And so I think that that's very important that's maintained.
So tell me about, because you gave me your time, tell me about your concerns about what the city of Gresham, again, with a chief chosen by a bunch of politicians and not by the people, but what is the city of Gresham proposing to do with its policing and how is this going to hit the citizens?
Oh, for sure. So one thing I will say is, I mean, you know, we are quite fond of the current chief that we have, and we are very fond of the last chief that we had. And so I think that they're, you know, I think that with our current chief, he's trying to toe the line between, you know, what executive leadership and what city councilors want versus, you know, how we navigate, you know, through all the issues that we're dealing with in the city of Gresham. So I just want to make sure that's very clear. We are supportive of our chief, but due to the environment that we're working in, due to the lack of officers and everything that we're dealing with at the moment, we are looking to, or actually we're not looking to, we are going to be eliminating our traffic division, our neighborhood enforcement team, and our transit division. And that's going to be happening on January 1st of this coming year.
Now, I'm sorry to say this, but you know, as a police officer, I understand why I'm saying this. I know to the citizens listening, they say, great. Fewer traffic tickets and you know, and big deal, except that sometimes the traffic cops are the ones who pick up the criminals out on wanted on a warrant, right? They're the ones who pick up the bad guys sometimes before they're able to do the bad thing they were planning to do next.
Oh, 100%. And then the other thing, of course, the service that they provide is, you know, DUI enforcement. DUIs kill people every year. Targeted speed enforcement of specific areas. I was actually talking to one of my colleagues the other day, and we had our traffic trailer out there that just basically does, it runs radar and it calculates speed. It doesn't, we don't issue tickets or anything based upon that. But the thing is, on Kane Drive or Kane Road, you know, near Division, we were picking up speeds from drivers of 117 miles an hour.
Wow.
And I mean, that is unheard of. And so when you don't,
it's also
have,
deadly,
like, force,
or potentially,
oh, absolutely. 100%. And when you don't have the force multiplier of a traffic division where you have individuals that are, you know, they're familiar with the process, they're very efficient. Not only that, too, but I mean, like hit and run accidents or just regular fender benders, those people are able to go out, process those scenes and move on rather quickly. Whereas if you're leaving it to a district officer to simply handle those things, you know, they're handling all the calls within their district. And then on top of that, you're just kind of adding, you know, to the workload that they're having to deal with already. So it's going to be problematic.
Tommy Walker is the president of the Gresham Police Officers Association that represents the officers. You mentioned the transit division. You may or may not remember when a cop showed up at a public hearing to testify about a light rail line that was being extended into a neighborhood. And he called it the crime train. That's
yeah.
True. And I'm wondering, by giving up the transit division, is Gresham deciding to cede the trains to criminals and people who are going to be involved in theft, in assaults, in drug dealing, and those kinds of things?
100%, yes.
Why are they doing this, Tommy?
Well, what we're dealing with right now is a significant staffing issue and a shortage of police officers here in the city. And you know, the city has come out And they've talked about, you know, the vacancy rate and, you know, hey, our budget's okay. And, you know, kind of like, look over here, everything's fine. Historically, we have had a really good police department and, you know, we have been able to retain officers. At this particular point in time, though, we have officers that are dropping off left and right.
Well, I guess what I'd wonder is if they're adequately funding it, why aren't you picking up some of the great cops that the bigger cities like Seattle and Portland have decided to give the bums rush to, both because they're prosecuting the people, they're threatening, they're not having the back of the blue, of the men and women in blue, and now most recently the vaccine mandate. How much of this shortage is actually manufactured by the actions of the government itself?
Well, and that's just it, and that's where I was about to go with this. We haven't even dealt with a potential vaccine mandate, which we're being told is coming down the pipeline. I should be learning more within the next week or so about how that's going to play out. The other part of it, though, and you had talked about, you know, public officials, elected leaders, you know, not outright, you know, supporting their police, you know, and I hate to beat a dead horse, you know, I hate to, you know, to talk about this over and over, but in terms of, you know, everything that we've been dealing with the civil unrest and how this all started, we didn't really have anybody come out on our behalf talking about how, hey, you know, this isn't happening here. And, you know, when you have protests that are happening on the front lot of City Hall and you're sending your police officers to go out there and deal with individuals who are, you know, screaming expletives that I can't say on the air at our police officers.
Hold that thought for just a second. I'm talking to Tommy Walker about cops here in a Northwest city. We're going to continue this in a moment. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'm holding up on calls for just a moment as I talk to Tommy Walker, who's been very generous with his time, the president of the Gresham Police Officers Association. So let me ask you this, just flat out. Is the city of Gresham disserving its citizens by not shifting resources and whatever you want to call the, you know, backing the blue, where they come out and they say, we're going to back up our officers, they can do the job, and we expect them to keep the peace and keep people safe. Are they disserving the citizens? And if so, what's going to make them change?
They're absolutely disserving the citizens by doing this. And we've gotten to a point with the lack of resources, you know, in terms of, and I just wanted to mention really fast too, cutting our neighborhood enforcement team, which deals with all the issues that you were talking about in your previous segment with the Willamette Week. It does us a huge disservice because, like I said, that starts to address the why people are leaving. And I'm not seeing any traction in terms of the city currently attempting to retain the officers that remain.
So what's going to change their mind? Because if they understand this, I mean, if I were to show up at a city council meeting, if they actually have one, you know, that's a real meeting where people can show up and sound off. I don't live in Gresham. But if a Gresham resident shows up and says, you are putting our lives at risk, what do they say in response to that?
You know, at this particular point in time, it seems that we're kind of getting, the city is being really provided with any type of straight answer. You know, the city's reaction is that they, you know, they want to come up with solutions and they want to be collaborative and they want to work together. But once again, we're just not seeing any we're not seeing any traction out of them.
I mean, that's just because look, Tommy, I always tell people that if you imagine the first towns in the Western United States, I said the first person they hired was not the diversity, equity, and inclusion manager. It wasn't buying a bunch of critical race theory from crap from Merrick Garland's son-in-law. It wasn't doing it. They hired a sheriff. Why? Because public safety is the first and principal, you know, obligation of a city, of a county, of a state, and of a nation, both at the national security level and for federal crimes. Public safety is your number one obligation. If you get that one right, it's nice to have nice streets and nice parks and nice everything else. But if you don't get public safety right, the rest of this stuff is just window dressing. And they're telling you we don't have the money to afford cops. One of the pieces of math I do for my audience that I don't see any other reporters doing, and I want to shame them into doing it. The city of Portland has a budget of around $5.5 billion. Now, do you know what they spend on cops? They cut it back to about $250 million. You say, hold on a second. Their biggest responsibility is public safety, and they spend 5 or 6% of their entire budget on it, and the other 95%, well, if you take out 5% more for the fire and emergency medical, you're spending 90% of your budget on the least important stuff, and 10% of your budget on the most important stuff, nobody can tolerate that kind of math. Except I don't, if every night on television, if every day in the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, if every day on the radio, you heard, this city is going to spend 90% of its money on something other than keeping you safe, I think people on city councils and mayors would change.
I agree with you. One thing that I have to note in terms of, you know, our financial issues within our city is that in terms of taxation, we are one of the lowest cities in terms of our size in the state. And that process goes all the way back to the early 1990s. The problem that we're dealing with is that, you know, obviously the need for resources increases, our budget stays flat, and then officers drop off. We currently have 12 vacancies. It's about to be several more. We could hire officers. The thing is, though, is that because of the political environment, it's difficult to find people to do this job. We could hire lateral officers, but the city of Gresham is not offering any type of incentive to bring lateral officers into our community. And so, you know, if we can go out and get new hires, it's going to take us at least 18 to 24 months to get them up to speed, functional, and working on their own.
Well, then why not the laterals? You know, I'll tell you what, I will offer to any member of the city council of Gresham or the mayor to come on and spend as much time as they want trying to explain this away. Because when you look around the landscape in the private sector, what's in short supply? Well, just about every kind of employee. You say, what about truck drivers? What about fast food people? They're offering signing bonuses. They're offering premium pay. They're saying, if you'll move from there to here, I'll give you a bonus, but you got to stay, you know, for a period of time to make the bonus worthwhile for both sides. And the city is saying, we're not going to do that. There's all this talent out there floating around. And we could grab onto it and bring it to our city, you know, talent already trained up, already certified, and they're not doing that? What can they possibly say is more important?
That's the difficult thing is that, you know, the immediate solution is retain what you have.
Right.
We cannot allow people to keep walking out the door. The intermediate solution is enticing people to come here. And then from there, we need to start talking about maybe a bond measure or what other sources of funding we're going to do to make this sustainable. But right now, with people leaving and walking out the door, we're not going to be viable much longer. The other thing, too, that I haven't disclosed yet is if this keeps going in this downward trajectory, we're going to be losing school resource officers in our mental health unit. And so some of these, you know, they explain it as, well, this is a reallocation. We're going to be giving bodies to detectives, you know, and putting them back on patrol. We have already we will be lowering our shift minimums, you know, minimum officers out on the road at any given time. And so from there, if you keep pulling from these units soon, you're not going to have any more bodies to produce. That's it. We're done.
How ugly is your response time picture right now?
Say that again.
How ugly is your response time picture? Because Portland and Seattle have gone to, I don't know, 11 minutes plus, something like that. And I always tell the people who listen to this show, they're nice enough to pay me the compliment of listening. I say, the next time you have, if you've ever had somebody in your household who's not breathing, their heart isn't beating, or they are bleeding out on the floor, and you call the cops, you know, for a first responder, they're going to send medical and cops and everyone else. But whoever shows up first, even if it's an officer, is going to stop the bleeding, start the breathing, start the heart. If it takes 15 minutes, is that okay with you? I don't think that's
absolutely
okay
not
with people. Well, what is it in Gresham right now? Because if you're shortchanging the shifts, I've got to believe that affects response time.
Well, absolutely. And then on top of that, what we're going to be dealing with is that there's just going to be certain things that we don't respond to anymore. And so it'll be, you know, emergencies only. And then as far as like our investigative units, what we're doing right now is we are literally investigating homicides, rapes, and child abuse. That's it.
So thefts, assaults, things like that, they just go by the wayside. Good luck. Write a report. File the report with your police. File it by email because you're not going to get a cop at your door.
Yes, that's where we're headed.
Well, do you know how big the whole city budget is?
I believe in our general fund, we're looking at something like $77 million.
And how much of that goes to the cops?
Gosh, I want to say that we are somewhere in the neighborhood. And like I said, this is where we're historically low when you compare us to other cities. But I believe we're somewhere floating in the area of like $43 million, I believe.
So more than half. I mean, at least you're better there. But sure. I would say then I would love to have the mayor or city council member tell me, what are you spending money on that isn't absolutely essential? Do what every family does. They pay the mortgage or the rent first. They pay the car payment and the utilities second and third. They spend what's left on food. And if they got nothing left over, you shift things around and you pay for the important stuff first. That's Tommy Walker from the Gresham Police Association representing the officers. Coming up in a moment, is the government making up fake rules for COVID? And I'll get to your phone calls and your emails on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And of course, yesterday, late in the day, an advisory panel that advises the FDA on the decisions it's going to make. The advisory panel voted 17-0 with one doctor abstaining to say the FDA should give full approval of a dose of the COVID vaccine for 5 to 11-year-old children. I thought I'd get the straight skinny on this from Dr. William Schaffner, who's an MD and medical director at the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Doc, thanks for coming back. We're glad for your expertise.
Good to be with you, Lars.
Now, I want to ask you about something in particular, and I'm going to play a soundbite. It might say it's a little tough to hear, but as one of the members of that advisory panel, and he said something that I thought was kind of extraordinary, although I understand this is one of the issues the advisory panel brought up. Let's listen to that bite from Dr. Eric Rubin. Take a listen.
But we're never going to learn about how safe the vaccine is unless we start giving it. Now, that's just the way it goes.
If you didn't hear that, Doc, he said, we're never going to learn about whether or not this vaccine is safe unless we just start giving it. It sounds like the Nancy Pelosi approach to legislation, pass the bill, and then we'll find out what's in it, which is, I guess, okay with laws. You can always rescind a law. But in this case, we've literally got people on the panel saying, it was tested on kind of a small panel, 3,000 kids, but it's probably safe enough. Start giving it, and we'll find out for sure whether or not it does bad things to kids. That doesn't sound like a good way to do medicine, does it, Doc?
Well, I think he was talking in medical shorthand, so let me expand his statements.
Please.
The first is, we've given this vaccine now to literally millions upon millions of people around the world, and we have a very good idea about what its safety profile is, down to age 12. And then, yes, we have 3,000 or thereabouts children who've received the vaccine at one-third of the dose to show that it makes the same amount of antibodies and has a safety profile that really mimics exactly what 12-year-olds, 13, 14-year-olds have shown. And so we have to remember that with the introduction of any new medication, whether it's a vaccine or a drug or anything else, at a certain point, you're going to have to give it to more people to find out if there are any unusual or unexpected, very rare effects. I mean, if they occur at 1 per million, nobody will ever do a study of 5 million people to try to determine whether a 1 per million adverse event occurs. That can only be determined by surveillance in the field, as we say. And we have the best vaccine safety surveillance system of any country in the world.
Are you talking about the VAERS system that collects evidence of adverse events?
I'm talking about a series of systems, one of which is indeed VAERS. That's correct.
Is VAERS a mandatory system? Every time a doctor runs into an adverse event, he or she must report it to this? Or is this just a voluntary where we collect evidence, but not in a systematic way? You might report it, you might not.
That's exactly correct. It is a voluntary system, and patients can report, doctors can report. Those are the raw data. You can't draw conclusions from those, but you can initiate investigations starting on those. And then, of course, we have systems that are in the VA, the Department of Defense, and there are other analytical systems that can be combined. We put all of those together in order to assess what the rare safety issues with vaccines are. And we've discovered several. For example, this thrombotic disease that occurs with the J&J vaccine, preferentially in young women. The myocarditis that we have found in largely younger adult and teenage men usually after the second dose, for example, of the mRNA vaccines. These are all needles in a haystack that we have discovered through this safety system, discovered, analyzed, described, so that the information is out to doctors and obviously to parents and recipients of the vaccine.
I'm talking to Dr. William Schaffner from the National Foundation for Infectious Disease. So let me ask you this. Almost everything in medicine is a weighing test. You say, okay, this has a benefit. It also has a detriment. And you weigh the two and you say it comes out on the side of detriment or it comes out on the side of a benefit. What should parents do? And more importantly, what should government bodies like school boards do? Should they force parents to get their kids vaccinated and say the benefit outweighs the possible detriment? Hey, it's only a relatively small chance that your kid may end up having a really bad effect from this. But the chance of the child catching COVID and having an adverse end is also relatively rare. How do you balance those two, Doc?
Yeah, it's very tough. And the Food and Drug Administration Advisory Committee had a real debate about that, and you're going to see that mimicked in the CDC's Advisory Committee. Also, I can't predict exactly what the CDC's Advisory Committee is going to do as regards which children ought to receive this vaccine. Now, apropos of what a parent should do, obviously, talk to your family doctor or pediatrician about this. And these debates will go on actually transparently, as you know, both the FDA committee and the CDC committee. Anybody can tune in real time. Nothing happens behind closed doors. They are debated very, very openly. And by the way, apropos of mandates, I don't think this vaccine is ready for a mandate yet, as you and I are discussing. It's much too new and controversial at the present time. So let's do this on a voluntary basis with a lot of information.
I see. Now, that's where I come down, Doc, especially on close calls. Because if I go to my doctor and the doctor says, well, we can do surgery or we can try, you know, some, you know, medicine or diet and exercise as an alternative. Now, they probably both have their upsides. If it's a tough call and it's a close call, I think that decision should always be up to me. And yet I'm anticipating that once the FDA, now having been told by his advisory panel to go ahead and approve it, when they do that, some of these government agencies out there, school boards in particular, are going to take this as license to ram it down the throats of parents. Do you think I'm wrong in anticipating that?
I think it's a reasonable question to ask, Lars, but I would be surprised. What, there are over 6,000 school boards in the United States, and you know how many states we have. And I think, although this may be discussed, I would be surprised if there are very many that will mandate this vaccine for children age 5 to 11. I would be very surprised at that.
By the way, Doc, I've heard one characterization that a 5, 6, 7-year-old has a greater chance of dying of the ordinary flu statistically than he or she does of having a death or a serious illness as a result of COVID. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, flu varies in its severity and its impact on children from year to year. But in terms of this age group, what we know so far is that over 8,000 children have been hospitalized. Almost 100 have died of COVID in this age group, 5 to 11.
Yep.
And in this age group, surprisingly, COVID is already one of the 10 leading causes of death. I think it's in eighth place or something like that. So this is, children are less seriously affected, but they're not unaffected by COVID. COVID is nasty.
Yeah, I understand that. Dr. Schaffner, thank you very much. That's Dr. William Schaffner, who is a medical doctor and the medical director for the National Foundation for Infectious Disease. When we get back, I'll get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Our Twitter poll today, should you pay taxes on the value of things you own when the value of those things goes up? That's what the IRS calls unrealized gains. Well, you haven't realized them, but Senator Ron Wyden, he wants to tax the stuff you've got, starting with billionaires, but he wants to do it on money you haven't received yet. Just say, hey, the value of that house went up. Why don't we tax that? He wants to start with billionaires, but believe me, Democrats will never stop with billionaires. Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show, and it's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Rob's on the line. Rob, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Good to have your voice in all of this, and just, listening to all the different things. I'm just wondering in what you think. I mean, what's it going to take for people to really, it's time to get out in front of this. You know, it just kind of feels like always trying to yell from behind or chase the courts.
I agree. But, you've got to get on the issue, though, before the decision is made, which is why I asked the doctor, should school districts mandate this? And his medical opinion, and you know the position he's coming from, he works for the National Center for Infectious Diseases. He is an MD himself. That gives him some credentials to say, no, since this is a tough call, it's a close call. Is the value of the vaccine greater than the value of going vaccine free? And he says that's a tough one. Now, if it was an easy one, if somebody said to you, Rob, you've got a headache, take some aspirin. And you say, well, I don't know if I want to take aspirin. You say, well, the aspirin in most cases for most people is not going to do anything bad to you, and it might make your headache go away. That's an easy call, right? But there are tough calls in medicine where you say, this woman needs to be operated on, but she's so elderly that the anesthesia may kill her. So the choice, don't operate, has its downside. Do operate, has a downside. When it's that close, who makes the decision? Parents and families make the decision, and he said school districts should not mandate this. Right?
Yeah, and it's just amazing. My question is what's it going to take? And I'm hoping that this is what it's going to be. I want to tell you what a couple things that we're doing in Clark County, your home county there, that we started about 2 weeks ago a mini initiative. So as you know, the people can do an initiative, and the Clark County Council then has to take up that, that ordinance, that call. And so we need 8,300 signatures. We've got a couple thousand already. We just started 2 weeks ago. We have 20 different locations in Clark County, and you can go to clarkcountygroup.com to see those different locations. But what this ordinance does, what we're calling the Clark County Council to do, is to ban all mandates that discriminate, because that's really at the heart of this, just as what you were just referring to. We're not anti-vaccine. We're not anti-COVID. We're anti-discrimination and tyranny. And so we're calling on the Clark County Council to ban all of these discriminating mandates that discriminate against someone's health medical status or violate their health information privacy.
It sounds reasonable. Are you having some event this weekend you mentioned?
Yeah. So, the FDA and the child vax mandates are coming. So we need people to get out in front of it. And so the sidewalk protest, we are going to line SR 503 from 4th Plain to 119th Street. We're going to line the sidewalks. And it's not anti, vaccine. It's really anti.
It's pro-choice. I know we're reluctant to say pro-choice because usually it's Democrats saying it and they mean killing babies. But there's a lot more to choice than killing babies. Rob, thanks for the update. I appreciate it. Let's go to Brett. Hey, Brett, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing today, Lars?
Quite well, sir.
So I just had some comments to make on the doctor that was just on here a few minutes ago. Something that I'm getting quite tired of not hearing doctors talk about as far as a vaccination goes. I remember back when the swine flu vaccination came out and when they were reporting to the VAERS database, 26 people had passed from it and they pulled the vax. And looking at the VAERS database now, we're at 75,000 people that have died from the vaccination. Why are we still pushing it like it's a lifesaver?
Actually, I don't know if the is that worldwide 75,000 under VAERS,
no,
or
no,
is that nationwide?
As far as I understand, VAERS is just the United States.
Yeah,
reported.
That's what I thought. So, and I think your numbers, I would, if I were you, when I hear that number, it makes me want to double check it. Because, Brett, and be aware of this, the internet, while full of good information, is also full of bad information. And if you wanted my assessment, the internet has more bad information on it than good. So you always have to be suspicious, and you want to double check, and where is the data coming from? VAERS has identified, as I understand it, tens of thousands of adverse effects, but I do not believe it is 75,000 deaths. And before you use that number more, I'd double check it and tell me the source. Let's go to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. Got to make it quick because we're close to the top of the hour.
Okay, Lars. Hey, I had a CDL for 35 years, learned how to drive big off-highway log trucks. Coming off of Mount St. Helens with 500 gallons of water on my truck, keeping the brake drums cool. Drove semis and low boys for rental local companies. They're such hurting for truck drivers. I'll get my CDL back. And come to find out, they want me to take a $5,000 school in order to learn how to drive.
And that is the government for you. This segment brought to you by NickShivers.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your phone calls and your emails. You can vote in our Twitter poll and find that at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. And if you can't stand Twitter like me, just go to our website. The vote counts the same. That's LarsLarson.com. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism right here on the Radio Northwest Network, we reach out to every corner of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. And the number is easy, 866. Hey Lars. Naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Now, Todd Myers is the environmental director over at the Washington Policy Center. Todd, I'm going to throw a ringer at you. I do want to talk about returning salmon and how they're faking the information or ignoring the facts, one or the other or both. But then I want to get to biofuel for just a moment because you and I swapped emails about that today. Welcome back to the program, and tell me what Washington State's lefty government is ignoring when it comes to the actual facts on the ground or in the water, in this case, about salmon recovery.
Well, the governor, Governor Inslee, and environmental community have been claiming that Snake River salmon are near extinction and that populations are declining. In fact, we've talked about before that some environmental activists are claiming that they will be extinct in about 5 years. Well, the salmon run, the 2021 salmon, Chinook salmon run for the Snake River has basically ended. There will be a few more that straggle in, but this is about the time when it ends. And it is 22% larger than 2020 and 71% larger than 2019. Now, 2019 was a very low year, and so we are recovering and we have more to go. But in 2 years ago, the environmental community was not putting the numbers in perspective and saying, well, this is a low part and there's a cycle. They were saying that 2019 showed that we were near extinction. But now that the numbers have gone up again, they haven't changed their tune. They keep saying the same thing, even though the data show clearly that they are wrong.
You know, Todd, it makes it sound like a bunch of doom and gloomers who always grab the number that shows that things are doom and gloom. But if things start to brighten up, they just put a pair of sunglasses on and ignore the facts in front of them.
Yeah, what's the opposite of rose-colored glasses? I guess, you know, black-colored glasses. They always see the worst. And in fact, they've been doing this for a long time. In 1999, they took out a full-page ad in the New York Times saying that Snake River salmon would be extinct by 2017 if we didn't remove the dams. Well, in 2017 was one of their highest years in the last 20 years. So they have been consistently wrong. But what's so interesting is that many of the reporters credulously report, the environmental community says that they're near extinction without putting those claims in context or without pointing out that the data contradict them. And I think that's the most frustrating thing is that we are making really bad decisions. We are putting money and resources where they won't help instead of where they will, instead of where we can actually help salmon and help the environment.
And by the way, the reason this has such a consequence, even if you're not a fisherman, and I go fishing occasionally with my friends, but I haven't done it in years. It's not one of my big passions. But even if you're not a fisherman, you have to understand, Northwest Natural Gas just came out today and announced they're going to have a 13% residential increase in nat gas costs. And of course, the region is trying to drive us toward all electric cars, all electric houses, electric heat, etc. And that's going to put pressure there. You start tearing out hydro dams and reducing the amount of the ability of the system to store water, because it's not just one dam on the Columbia and then on the Snake that feeds into it. It's a lot of dams that all interact with each other to one extent or another, and most of them generate hydropower. You start tearing that out, and all of a sudden something we have to have, a necessity in our society, electricity, becomes increasingly expensive.
Well, that's exactly right, and you don't have to trust Lars or Todd. You can trust the environmental community, the Northwest Energy Coalition, which is a left-wing environmental group focusing on energy that wants to tear down the Snake River dams, did a study a few years ago saying that tearing down the dams would not only increase costs, it would actually increase CO2 emissions and make blackouts more likely. So it's kind of the worst of all worlds, according to their own study, and yet Governor Inslee and Senator Patty Murray of Washington want to spend more money to study what will happen if we tear down the dams. Well, we know what will happen. Every study says the same thing. They're hoping that this time, when they spend yet more money, that the numbers will change. But there's no reason they should, because the answers are very clear.
Now, Todd, I shot you something from one of the transit agencies here in the Northwest, and this one is TriMet. I like to call them UnMet, as in unmet expectations. But they announced today, and I'm sure they'll get a lot of fanfare, their friends in the media will say, look, isn't this great? They're going to move from conventional diesel, which is made from oil pulled out of the ground, to what they call biodiesel. They're at 5% biodiesel now. They're going to go to 99%. You say, isn't that great? We can grow diesel. Well, diesel don't grow on trees. What they're talking about is a product that's made out of waste oil, most of it organic waste oil, as in, I know McDonald's makes a lot of French fries, and so do the other fast food joints. It's the waste oil from cooking. It's waste oil from other processes that didn't come out of the ground. They came off of plants. And so they've declared it, oh, it's so much cleaner and greener to burn biodiesel in our buses. It's also more expensive. And I don't buy the argument necessarily when they say, well, gee, if this came from waste cooking oil, that this is superior, that it's going to be a better product. In fact, all I hear from the truck drivers is what a disaster biodiesel is for engines.
That's exactly right. There is a cost in terms of equipment and other things like that. But that's sort of speculative. It can be hard to quantify. What is easier to quantify is the cost simply of the diesel. Of the renewable diesel. California and Oregon both have what's called the low carbon fuel standard, where they use renewable diesel to meet certain targets. And the cost is anywhere from about $150 a metric ton to $200 a metric ton. So you say, okay, what the heck does that mean, Todd? Well, $150 a metric ton is about $1.50 extra a gallon, and $200 is not quite $2 a gallon. So it's extremely expensive compared to the alternatives. And the other thing is that it's not just the cost. It is that there are better ways to reduce CO2 emissions. I can do things.
Haven't you said that there are ways to do it at $10 a ton?
$10 a ton. That's exactly right. So it's not just wasteful in terms of money. It's wasteful in terms of the environment. If you believe that climate change is a crisis, why would you get one metric ton of reduction when you could get 20? And the reason is that a lot of this stuff is more about political posturing and political image than it is about the environment. So they will put out the press release, they will pat themselves on the back, but at the end of the day, they've done very little that's good for the environment at very high cost.
Well, the other thing I wonder about, Todd, and we're going to have to save most of this for another day, but when they say we're going to use waste oil, well, how much cooking oil is there? I mean, it doesn't add up to the kinds of quantities that we use when it comes to fuel to drive cargo and trucks and things like that. There isn't that much of it. So at some point, I have to imagine what they're planning to do is say, let's grow crops, the old biodiesel where you grow a bunch of corn and then you turn the corn into ethanol. Well, now they're going to want to do it for diesel. it isn't going to work. They're going to have to generate massive quantities. There'll be lots of subsidies attached to it. You can find what Todd Myers writes at the Washington Policy Center. When we come back, I'll get to your phone calls and your emails, and we'll talk about the carpetbagger candidate for Oregon governor, Nicholas Kristof, has launched his bid. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you to take your calls and to give you my take on a few things. One, should you pay taxes on the value of things you own when the value of those things goes up? Think about your car. Think about maybe your 401k or your IRA. It almost certainly has some stocks in it. When those stocks go up in value and you say, someday I'm going to sell that stock and my wife and I are going to retire on it. Or my husband and I are going to retire, either whichever way it works for you. That when you say, but I don't have to pay taxes on that gain in value until I actually sell it. Well, Chairman Ron Wyden, who is chair of the Senate Finance Committee, has an idea. And he wants to start with billionaires, but I don't think he's going to end with billionaires. He says those 600 or 700 people in America who are worth $1 billion or more, and they have a lot of things that are worth a lot of money, and those things have gained value over the years. The IRS calls that unrealized gains, and that's the key part of it. It is not part of your income. If you bought your house for these days, it almost sounds like a joke to say buy a house for $300,000 because the typical cost in Seattle is north of $600,000 and the typical cost in Portland, I think, is north of $500,000. But say you bought it for, you know, $300,000 and today it's worth $500,000. On paper, you have made $200,000. You don't pay taxes on that. Why? Because you haven't realized the gain yet. You haven't sold it. When you sell it, if you don't reinvest it and get an exemption under that law, then you're going to pay taxes on it. He wants people to pay taxes on the value of things they have as the value goes up, and they haven't explained it all. Well, what happens if the value goes up and then it goes back down? I mean, ask Elon Musk about that. Ask Jeff Bezos about that. When the stock price jumps and they say, hey, Bezos made $7 billion today. Can you imagine the IRS saying, okay, Jeff, we want the taxes on the $7 billion. And then 2 days later, the stock goes back down and he loses $7 billion. Does he get his money back? And do you really believe that they're going to start with billionaires and not go to the rest of us? And I've pointed out the tax history in the United States. 108 years ago, the U.S. Congress passed the law that allowed for an income tax in the United States. It started out when people, the average person, made $300 a year, about a buck a day. That's how much people made back then. And they said, we're going to start with people who make over $3,000 a year. So in other words, you're telling in America, where somebody might say, well, I make $300 a year and I'm hoping to get to $400 a year. We're only going to tax the people above $3,000. Well, I'm never going to get to that. Okay. And it was a 1% tax on income above $3,000. Do you know what it is today? It's taxes on income that half of American workers pay. Some are making amounts so small they don't pay, but about half pay and half do not. And the average amount paid by everybody, top to bottom, is 14% of your entire paycheck. And if somebody from 1913 or 1914 were to see today and say, I remember the income tax, it only applied to super rich people and it was only 1%. And now we say, no, it applies to virtually everybody and it's an average of 14% and can go as high as almost 40%. The person in 1913 would have said, we never thought they'd go there. You know what? I think they'll go there. Let's go to Butch and Tukwila listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KVI. Hey, Butch, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Well, first of all, thanks for taking my call. And sure. Another thing, I've never disagreed with anything you've said. I've been listening for like a year.
Is there a but
anyway,
coming?
I want to bring up.
Usually there's a but at the end of that, Butch.
No, no, you're good. I want to just mention Boeing. All of Boeing, maybe United States, at least in Washington, as of December 8th, everybody has to be fully vaccinated, or it's not been fully said yet, but possibly lose your job. I just want to mention that.
Do you think that makes sense?
I haven't heard that on the radio yet.
Do you think that makes sense? I mean, we've talked about this quite a bit, about how foolish this is. As the doctors are saying, we're about to reach herd immunity, they think by December. You say, well, then why do you need to fire all these engineers, ferry pilots, cops, firefighters, paramedics, doctors, nurses? The list goes on and on and on. Do you think it makes sense to fire those people when we're about to hit herd immunity?
Absolutely not, and I've thought that since the beginning of all this talk.
Well, now watch. FDA is about to approve. They haven't yet. They've just had a recommendation to approve the vaccine for 5-year-olds and above, 5 to 11-year-olds. Do you think schools should mandate that all those kids have to be vaccinated to go to school?
Absolutely not. My kid is 19, and I have a 26-year-old. They're not in school anymore. But if they still were, heck no.
Yep, I think the decision should be made by you, Butch. As the parent, you should be making the decision. Let's go to Tim in Medford. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening on the network and on KMED. What's on your mind today?
Yes, sir. I just wanted to add something to the biodiesel discussion. And there is an additional type of biodiesel that's not made from cooking oil. It is made from fats, oils, and greases in edible byproducts, say Tyson Foods, the largest protein producer in the world. They have all these fats, oils, and greases that are not edible. These are sold on Wall Street to mainly synthetic producers of cosmetics. But now they're using them, and they re-crack them using the Fischer-Tropsch process, turn it into syngas through gasification, and it turns it into really a very, very clean, high BTU burning aviation fuel and gasoline, which is perfect.
How expensive is it? Because
that, military.
Just what you just described sounds awfully expensive, Tim, is it?
You know, as far as I could research, I didn't find a cost per gallon. And the fact that it's purchased by our U.S. military, I don't know. That's kind of
I will tell you, Tim,
electricity.
A number of years ago, the Navy was bragging that they were going to start experimenting with biofuels for their jets. And they were talking prices in the range of $20 or $30 a gallon. You know, in other words, it's fashionable to use it. The question is, does it make economic sense to use it, especially when we've shortchanged our military so much? They have so much to rebuild. If you say, well, you all have to buy fuel, now we're going to dramatically increase your fuel costs. A country that is on an ocean of oil, we are the Saudi Arabia of North America, and we've got all this oil we could pull out of the ground. You say, but it's more fashionable to use this biofuel or biodiesel or oils that are cracked, you know, from one way or another, you know, whether it's cooking oils or oils that are products of other processes that didn't come originally from the ground. They came from plants and things like that. Do you think we should be doing that?
Well, you know, it's an alternative to what's happening now when we're going to be sending our young men back to the Middle East to fight for
oil. No, hold on, Tim, Tim, did you miss what I just said? We're not sending anybody back to the Middle East right now. Number two, we didn't get any oil by going to the Middle East, never have and won't. That is a region that if there's trouble there and it affects us, we should protect national security. Why would we have to go to the Middle East for oil when on the day Joe Biden took the oath of office, January 20th, America was self-sufficient for oil and natural gas, probably for the next 100 years?
Well, I agree completely. I think what was done previously by the administration was great, you know, making us a net oil exporter. I think that.
Well, we're not anymore. I appreciate the call. Coming up, why would a state order 1 million ballots a week before the 2020 election? We'll talk about it next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Just vote in our Twitter poll. Just find it at Lars Larson Show or at LarsLarson.com. And if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. If you're one of those people like me that still has big questions about the legitimacy of the November 3rd election, just keep your powder dry and stick to your guns, because the fact is there are big questions to be resolved. And it seems that every week that goes by, there's a new enterprising journalist who comes up with yet another piece of data for which there is no explanation that I can imagine. One of those examples was research by Kevin Moncla, who's an independent investigative journalist. His work's been featured at Uncover DC and the Gateway Pundit and other good locations. Kevin, welcome to the program. How are you?
Doing great, Lars. Thanks for having me.
So tell me this. Is there an easy way to explain why the state of Georgia, one of the battleground states about which there are questions about the vote counting that night, where we saw the vote counting shut down because of an alleged water main break that turned out to be a leaky urinal in the convention center, and then security cameras that picked up people doing something mysterious with whole suitcases full of ballots. And, you know, they were picked up on security cameras they apparently knew didn't know were there. And they said, oh, that's just the usual stuff. We had shut down vote counting, but we had people with suitcases full of ballots that were caught on security cameras. But pay no attention. Nothing to see here, folks. Is there a reason Georgia would have ordered 1 million, the delivery of 1 million blank ballots and Democrat ballots at that, not Republican ballots, the week, 1 week or 10 days before the November 3rd election?
I can't come up with one.
Okay, now tell my audience about the story. What do we know about these 1 million ballots that showed up on pallets a week or 10 days before November 3rd?
Well, they had contracted a printing company to both print and mail their absentee ballots. So the company would get the information and then mail the ballot directly to the voter. So there was no reason for the county to be ordering absentee ballots. And I saw it in one of the funding lines, some large expenses for printing, and it didn't make sense. So I did an open records request, or Georgia's version of a FOIA request, and after some persistence, got one of the invoices that showed that they ordered all these ballots, and the timing didn't match.
Well, because they showed up, they were delivered on October 24th. If they're sending out absentee ballots and the election is on the 3rd of November, you wouldn't be sending out ballots that you only received on the 24th of October, would you?
That's correct. Plus, they didn't order any envelopes.
Oh, that's right. They ordered the ballots, but no envelopes for absentee ballots. Does Georgia offer you any kind of response when you ask the next question, which is, what were you doing with all these ballots for a particular election?
Gabriel Sterling did offer a response, and he said that because of COVID, that they had some problems with their legally required logic and accuracy testing, which is a procedure that makes sure the machines are performing correctly before the election. But that issue was settled before the order, and it was settled by a court decision on Sunday, October 11th. And actually, the machines began being used on October 12th. So his excuse doesn't hold water.
Would you mind? I also said these were Democrat ballots. I'm correct in that, right? There was an issue of barcodes on the ballots. Can you explain to my audience why the barcodes showing up or not showing up on a ballot are significant in Georgia?
Actually, I can't. I'm not sure about that part of the story. That was from Jovan Pulitzer, and that was not through my investigation. I think Gary funded out of that.
You just found out that they had the ballots delivered. My understanding was they were ordered as ballots printed without the barcodes on them, which is the way the Democrats' ballots are prepared. Republican ballots, for whatever reason in Georgia, have a barcode on them, and then there are barcode readers. And I don't know why any state would have ballots that are different, you know, from one party to another for a general election. In a general election, everybody's voting without regard to party. So why they would do that, I don't know. But if you don't have any insights into that, what else do we know about this? And are there other things that would raise suspicions?
Well, there was a separate and a second and separate order at the same time for another a little over 300,000 ballots of the same kind from a different printer in Florida. So it seems like even if the logic and accuracy testing was the issue, they ordered way too many ballots for Fulton County. Fulton County paid for over 1 million ballots, and they only have the total number of voters that voted in the general election was 580,000, I believe. So there's really no excuse.
No, and I guess what makes all of us want, because all the way through there have been questions about Georgia had ballots that were allegedly mailed in, but they weren't folded. And you say, but the envelopes they go into require them to be folded. How do you end up with absentee ballots that aren't folded? And I guess a lot of us have imagined because they never got sent out, they never got returned, they were just created and then fed into the system. What else have you found that would lead people to have questions, legitimate questions, about the outcome of the Georgia part of the presidential election?
Well, it would be really easy to determine if the ballots were innocent and for the reasons they described, but they destroyed them right after the election, which is also curious because otherwise we could go in and count the ballots, see how many are missing. Another issue is that the boxes are have been opened. They've been in use. The ballots were accessed from those boxes. If they weren't used, then they shouldn't have been accessed at all.
Well, and weren't they under a court seal? Hadn't a judge said that while there were still court actions going on until very, very recently, the last few weeks, that if a judge says this stuff isn't to be touched, then it stays sealed up, doesn't it?
That's supposed to be the way it is. It's supposed to maintain everything for 22 months, but evidently they didn't think that applied.
I mean, because, look, elections come and go. You have an election, and then you hang on to the ballots for a period of time under state law, and then you destroy them, and then you clear space for more ballots. But would there have been a downside to the elections department hanging on to these pieces of paper until the whole thing has been sussed out?
Oh, except for space. It was 22 ballots. I mean, pallets of ballots. Like 2 18-wheeler loads, if I estimate correctly.
But the next time you're going to need that space, I assume, is the next midterm election coming up in the fall of next year, right?
You would think, yes, sir.
I would say, well, you know, you've got lots of space. I mean, you're not going to put any other used ballots there until fall of next year. Why? What do you want the space for? And that doesn't make any sense either. Are there any other court actions that are still underway, Kevin, that you, to your knowledge?
There is the one that you were talking about that was dismissed by the court is now being appealed by Garland Favorito, trying to get access to the ballots, and I'm in contact with him as well.
Because but
there's a lot that's gone on in Georgia. I mean, I had a previous article about 10 days ago showing that Dominion was contracted for over $2 million to pay for staffing the election, the running of the machines. Because of COVID, most of the county staff was put on quarantine and sent home.
But they can trust the election to a private company that actually makes the voting machines. And then when they carry out an election, the people can ask the elected officials and their staff, but then they just say, well, we farmed it out to somebody else, I guess, at a cost that was lower than having the actual county employees at the elections department do their jobs. That's Kevin Moncla, who writes stories for Uncover DC and the Gateway Pundit about that mysterious million ballots that showed up a week or 10 days before the 2020 election. But take the Georgia officials' word for it. Nothing to see here, folks. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Yes, it is, and it's the Radio Northwest Network serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and 25 great radio stations out there. Our Twitter poll today, should you pay taxes on the value of things you own when the value of those things goes up? You see, the Democrats, they want to have a massive new tax, but they don't want to call it a wealth tax. And in fact, Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary for Joe Biden, which kind of tells you where she's coming from, she came out and said, we have to tax these things because unrealized gains, which is a fancy IRS term for you buy a house for $300,000 and it goes up to $400,000. The $100,000 increase is an unrealized gain. And when do you realize that gain? When you sell the house. You have a capital gain. Now, when it comes to houses, a certain amount of capital gains are excused and you don't have to pay taxes on them. If you buy a stock for $1,000 or a bunch of stock for $1,000 and it goes up to $2,000, you have a $1,000 gain when you sell it. Well, here's the Democrats' idea coming from Senate Finance Committee Chair Ron Wyden, Democrat Party member, never had a real job in his life, doesn't even live in the state he represents. He lives in New York City with his family, his wife and small children. He has now proposed to tax the yearly change in the value of people's assets, but he wants to start only with the billionaires. Now, he's actually got a constitutional problem with that, because there's a thing called a bill of attainder, another fancy term that means the Congress and your state legislature cannot pass laws that only affect either a single person or a very small group of people. This was banned. It's banned in the Constitution. So the Congress can't pass a law that says this one is to either tax one person. Like if the Democrats thought they could pass a tax that says we will have a 100% rate of taxation on people whose last name is Trump and first name is Donald and middle initial is J, they would pass a law like that in a heartbeat. But that would be a bill of attainder. There's a constitutional problem when you pass a tax and say it's only going to apply to the roughly 700 billionaires in the United States. That one's going to go to the courts immediately. But the bigger concern for me is that when the Congress passes laws and says, don't worry about it, it's only going to affect the super, super, super rich like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and Warren Buffett and people like that. We're not going to tax you little people. Don't believe it, because it has never been the case. When the Congress passes an income tax, I told you, the income tax we all pay today started out as a tax on the ultra wealthy. It was people who made more than $3,000 a year. In fact, in 1913, when they passed it, they said, if you make less than $3,000, you pay zero. If you make more than $3,000 a year, you pay 1%. And if you get up, can you imagine what the stratosphere would have looked like at that time? When you say, if the average American in 1913 made $300 a year, not a week, not a month, $300 a year, can you imagine making $500,000 a year, more than 1,000 times as much as the average worker in America? Well, let's see. The average worker in America today makes about $40,000 a year. Now, 1,000 times that would be $40 million. If somebody had a paycheck of $40 million a year, that would be the comparison proportionately. So should you have to pay taxes on the value of things you own, on the wealth that you have? And start with billionaires. We'll get to the rest of you later. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go first to Keith. Hey, Keith, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, first off, back to the dams and biodiesel. If you kind of take away the dams and a lot of these people that raise all the crops you make biodiesel out of, that doesn't make a lot of sense there.
No, it doesn't.
But anyway, and then to the forced vaccinations through schools, and I think you and I are probably about in the same age group and probably remember back when they did the polio vax and the smallpox stuff, you know, back in the 60s. Well, it started in the mid-50s, and it was kind of a mandatory thing. After they did a blind study with a polio, I guess, for the first year from 54 to 55.
Okay, but Keith, without all the history, we got to get to the point because I don't want you to run out of time.
Well,
people blame me when you run out of time.
It's the parents that should be deciding what happens with their children, not mandated. And there's been permission slips going out to parents for years and years, and that's what it ought to be. If you want your child vaccinated, sign a permission slip. If you don't want them, say no.
I get it. But Keith, what are we to do? Because I'm anticipating, maybe not where you live, but I'm anticipating the bigger cities in the Northwest are going to try to make this mandatory. They're going to tell the parents, if your kid does not get the COVID vaccine, the experimental vaccine, that even the doctors say, we aren't going to know whether or not it's safe till we start giving it to all these kids. We have a soundbite of one of the doctors who made the recommendation saying exactly that. What are parents to do when those school districts start saying, you don't have any choice, we've made the choice for you? What should their reaction be?
Well, their reaction is you teach your children at home and don't send them to their school.
Yep.
And like my daughter does right now, and they've already been, a lot of the parents that I know of have turned down about some of the other mandated vaccinations that kids have before they can go to school, so they just homeschool. You got computerized education now that can handle that.
Not a bad idea. Keith, thanks for the call. This segment brought to you by Marquee Hot Tubs, the ultimate hot tub and swim spa experience. Visit online or one of their three locations, marqueehottubs.com. And this is the Radio Northwest Network.